And he said, here, go read this. And from that point forward, I started a life headed towards being a software developer. I thought that's what I was going to do all the way from third grade, off in high school. I went to college specifically to study computer science with that in mind.
Welcome to the Disruptive Innovators, Champions of Digital Business podcast, where IT and digital leaders from around the world talk about their careers, their inspiration, and their vision for the future of digital business. I'm your host, David Wright. The world of digital business is evolving faster than ever, and I want this to be a place where digital business champions create a village to band together and help each other navigate the ever-changing terrain. Disruptive Innovators features conversations with CIOs and digital leaders from around the world, diving into their personal backstory, career, their current role, trends they've been seeing, and their vision for the future, personally, professionally, and otherwise. This podcast is made for people who are seeing how quickly the digital business landscape is evolving, those who recognize that it takes a village of trusted advisors to navigate this ever-changing terrain, people who enjoy listening to high-level discussions surrounding what it means to be a leader, real-world examples of challenges faced, and industry-specific strategies leveraged to create exceptional business outcomes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.
Good morning, friends. David Wright here, and I am your host of the Disruptive Innovators, Champions of Digital Business podcast. And this morning, I am lucky enough to be joined by Brian Rowe. Brian, pleasure to have you on.
David, it's great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, I know it's been a little time in the making now. So, Brian, for those of our listeners who might not be familiar, can you just tell everybody a little bit about your current role?
Yeah, love to. So I'm currently the vice president of IT for a company that sort of like BASF, nobody's really ever heard of, but we try to make life better. So I work for a company called Rarig Pacific Company. We're a 111-year-old, a family-owned manufacturing company. We've been building containers that are used in supply chain and logistics since 1913. Today, that looks like mostly plastic containers. We do lots of recycled and mixed-use containers that are used by large companies across the U.S. that are in the logistics supply chain space. So beverage, beer delivery, agriculture, e-commerce. We also do a significant amount of business in residential waste hauling. So depending on who manages your residential waste, you may have a Rarig Pacific trash can or a Husk Light or Husky Light cart, a recycle bin, organics collection, or waste collection sitting in your garage. So that's what I do today.
Very cool. Yeah, it's an interesting space too. And to someone on the outside, it might not seem like it right away, right? But I know we had an executive from Tosca on not too long ago, and he educated me about a bunch of stuff that I had no idea went on in regard to collapsible egg crates and all sorts of IoT that goes on in that space. Yeah, I'll be definitely interested to learn more about what you guys are up to. First and foremost, though, Brian, we like to just start the episode with one piece of actionable advice you might look to leave everybody with today.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the thing that I would say, if you walked away with nothing else, as a career technologist who fought hard to stay out of IT, but ultimately ended up running an IT shop, the number one piece of advice that I share with people, and my staff hears this from me often, every one of our problems is a people problem. We may be dealing with a cloud service outage. We may be dealing with something that is technical in nature, but at the end of the day, those things service human processes that deliver product and services to our customers. And I think as technologists, as technology leaders, as innovators, sometimes we lose sight of the fact that at the end of whatever we're building, there's a person who needs a product, a person who has to drive a business process. So I think if you walked away with nothing else, it's that whether you work for a small shop or a big shop, every problem in front of you is ultimately a human problem.
I love the way that you put that. And I've had that conversation before with folks, and I agree wholeheartedly that it's something that I think, like you mentioned, as a technologist, I can lose sight of sometimes. And Rachel Lockett, I think she titled her book, technology doesn't matter, which is provocative, but 100%, I think that is something that people really need to, or that I need to continuously keep at the forefront of my mind. So Brian, let's talk a little bit about how you started out. You said you've tried to stay out of IT to a certain extent. How did you start out? What was your journey like? And how did you get to the point that you're at in your career today?
Yeah. I usually start answering that question by talking about the fact that I am a child of a family where when you would say things like, oh, it's not rocket science, I would usually look at my friends and go, yeah, but I know it. Now, my dad wasn't a rocket scientist, but he was a nuclear engineer, and he spent his entire life doing very complex, very real things in the power industry. And so there were no problems that we didn't tackle at home, whether it was car or this. And I remember as a third grader going to my dad and saying, man, I'm bored. And he was working on his professional engineering recertification, and he flipped over to his desk and he grabbed a book on Objective-C and he said, here, go read this. And from that point forward, I started a life headed towards being a software developer. I thought that's what I was going to do all the way from third grade, off in high school. I went to college specifically to study computer science with that in mind. And halfway through college, I realized how little joy I got out of sitting in a computer lab and writing code. I enjoyed solving the problems, but it was fairly sterile, and like it didn't give me the sense of fulfillment that I had hoped to get out of what I was trying to achieve with my life, which was really solving problems, seeing the impact of those problems solved on the people around me. And at that point I said, okay, great, then probably my life is not going to be spent building software, even though at the time I was freelance writing software. I was like, that's how I was supporting myself, and it's what I was studying. I changed majors, had fun conversations with my parents about what are you going to do with the history degree? And I'm like, whatever I want. I'm already writing software for a living, so I think I can manage. I then pursued a few different academic arenas, not really knowing exactly what I wanted to be when I grew up. And at some point along the path, I was doing some consulting with some nonprofits around technology, finding that there were, in the real world, there were lots of people who were really good at their jobs and really poor at understanding how technology could help make their lives better. And of course, this was 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago. So not in the IoT sense of the world of like my thermostat just learns on its own, but more in thinking about how business process could be reshaped with the right technology to reduce work, improve accuracy, and just generally make things better. It was with that kind of mindset that I left working for myself and I went to work for Dell, and I carried a Dell badge for 10 years, 3 or 4 months shy of 10 years. And in that time, like I learned a lot, but I learned more about business than I did about technology. I often hear people talk about Dell and they say, oh yeah, Dell, you're like, dude, you're getting a Dell. And they think about the marketing things and they think about how many times they see the logo. And they often will come back and say, wow, they're a really innovative technology company. Now, I don't know if Michael finds himself on your subscribers list, so maybe he'll cringe when I say this. But one of the things that I would say as an insider is that Dell's real key to success wasn't technology innovation. It was supply chain management. If you were at least a few years ago to go to Harvard Business School and look through in their executive courses, they still did a case study about Dell, but it wasn't about disrupting technology as much as it was about how they managed their cash conversion, how they managed suppliers, how that converted from order to shipped product in as short a time as possible, because it was revolutionary and to a large degree still is. But I think as your listeners may know, if they've worked for large organizations, one of the first things that you learn when you work for a massive corporation is that, sort of like Congress, it's largely baked on inefficiency, right? There's things that you go, why is this so complicated? And it's complicated because there's a lot of voices involved. There's a lot of stakeholders that need to have their challenges met. So I went to work for Dell. I actually started in sales. Turns out I was a really terrible salesperson, but quickly found a home in sales operations, solving problems. And because I spoke the technology language, I could look at a solution and go, great, we need to piece this together and grab this off the shelf. I need to go to IT and only ask them for this, but they don't have to build anything and they don't have to support anything. I was able to start building a reputation as someone who could walk in, solution the business process problem, and wrap the right set of technology that was easy to support. And then I continued to work myself out of a role, became a fixer, right? Effectively, like I got handed to a team, we'd go in and reshape how they were functioning, go build a little tool here, a little robotic process automation there, and then turn around and go, great, now you don't need me, and move on to the next team. And I did that for a significant number of years. And during most of that time, I had a very good friend who was Dell's network security architect. And about one time a month, he'd say, hey, you really need to come talk to my boss and come work in security. And I kept saying, man, that's too much like IT. And I can tell you from the outside, when I'm dealing with IT, it's painful and nobody over there seems happy. And at the time, I think Dell changed a lot in the last couple of years I was there, but we worked for a major hardware manufacturer, and yet we were several generations behind because of the way IT needed to manage assets and things like that. So it was very challenging. It was like, man, that felt like a place where good technology ideas go to die. I'd rather stay out here in the business. Odd result of that is that I learned a lot about how businesses run, and in some cases don't run well. I remember I was working in finance and Dell had hired a new CEO or CFO, and he'd been there about 90 days, had everybody together for a big all hands. There's 10,000 finance people sitting in one room. And during the Q&A, somebody asked him, what has surprised you most in your first 90 days at Dell? And he said, honestly, it's how much of this business is run out of Excel. We have these monster enterprise tools, Hyperion and other things. So you guys are all just operating the entire business out of Excel, which I think was a fair assessment. So I learned a lot about how finance works and about how businesses make money and how the solutions that we build have to drive value for the organization. And even learning to articulate that early before I ever worked in IT gave me a leg up. By the time I finally listened to my friend and said, okay, great, I'll come talk to your boss and we'll talk about maybe looking at a role in security. I worked in almost every division at Dell except for IT and procurement, and had not spent too much time anywhere, but spent enough time everywhere to understand how the business was pieced together. And then I started working in corporate security for data security specifically. I really found a home. It was a place that the types of problems that security engineers and architects deal with are Rubik's Cube level. Like, I now have to manage 50 factors and we have to understand how they impact the entire organization. We can't do things that degrade the speed of click-through rates on Dell.com, because if you do, it's going to actually increase cart abandonment, and that has real revenue impacts. So thinking about the solution start to finish for the business, being able to articulate the value of what we were trying to achieve, I think really built a foundation for me to go through a process of learning how to be an executive, learning how to think carefully about those human problems, and understanding that, you know, the roadmaps that got leaked. I think at one point Dell was Engadget's leakiest company of the year. That actually generated a phone call from Michael to the CISO, who stood up a new team to do data loss prevention. And that's the role I got hired into, because they were like, great, I understood. I worked in product management. I understood the roadmap problems, some of the IP problems. And so that's what I spent most of my time doing, was thinking about how do we facilitate the product development process, try to be innovative, not leak information that's going to impact EPS, but also deal with salespeople who are really excited to share new sexy things that the organization is doing. How do you balance all of it? Wrap technology around it, but not expect the technology solves it. That was great. I ended up leaving Dell about a year after the privatization, in no small part because one of the things that I learned at a large company was it started to become really difficult at my level to have an impact. We'd spend a lot of time proposing projects, investing lots of time and effort and energy, and then not really have the executive level support to be able to push things through, or things that were aligned at mid-tier executive level weren't aligned with the global strategy that Dell and or that Michael and his team were trying to achieve. And so they just got lost in the noise. And that, to me, became very frustrating, not because there was anything wrong with the company, but very specifically because I want to be able to hop into a place, solve a problem, and then see that problem like actually impact business results or the business people. Once I feel like I lost that opportunity, I started thinking and at least returning calls. I went to work for a small shop after that that's subsequently been acquired by Broadcom, but they were building security software in the user and entity behavior space. Very different customer sets. I was actually on the customer side at that point, overseeing some implementations. So taking what I knew out of corporate security, and then working with organizations that were Dell size, but in financial services or in telecom, helping them think about their insider threat problems and how they could leverage the platform of what was then Bay Dynamics to solve some of those challenges. And that was an interesting time for me because I realized between the reasons that I left Dell and then what I was seeing in the strategic discussions that I was part of with the Bay team, what I really wanted was less of a living somebody else's adventure, but like having a seat at the table to have a discussion about how can we leverage technology at a senior level to shift the strategy of an organization or deliver the strategy of an organization. And it's a fairly lengthy answer to your question, but that's part of what landed me at Rarig. I got a call. I'd been at Bay 2.5 years. I had some really good discussions with the co-founders and my boss about what I thought my future direction looked like. They were incredibly supportive. They also recognized on my behalf that I was probably not going to achieve those aims working with them just because of the trajectory they were on in terms of growth. And there was not going to be a senior IT leader at the organization because it was going to stay pretty small. And I got a call to build a security program for Rarig, not IT. I probably wouldn't have returned that call, but to build a security program for Rarig Pacific. And my boss, who was the CTO, looked at me and goes, you need to take that call. This feels like a really good fit. Even though at the time I knew nothing about manufacturing. So I had to learn a lot in the last 5.5 years about how a different organization functioned. Family owned, much smaller, orders of magnitude smaller than Dell, but also I work for a company whose ethos is about improving the lives of its employees by delivering excellence to customers, right? It's not about bottom line. We're not a publicly traded company. And so the decision-making frameworks get to be very different. In some ways challenging, but also very positive.
Yeah. No, I love that. We've thought a lot about ethos in the last number of years internally. And it's funny, growing up, I thought I was going to be building computers. My best friend's dad worked for Microsoft and his mom worked for Compaq, or maybe it was the opposite, but like we had like access to all the newest tech back in like the 90s and I was going to go to RPI, but I diverted prior to college. I was like, you know what? I just want to move to New York and become like a big shot, work in like finance or whatever people do. And I hated it. But nowadays, more than ever, what you're saying about just starting with the fundamental kind of, or what I'm hearing is like starting with the fundamental business process issue or the operation concern, or and then seeing how technology can help to facilitate a different outcome with the understanding that you're still going to have to actually leverage people to change the process, right? The technology will help, but usually things need to change with the way people are acting, like there's a governance to that on an ongoing basis. I actually talk about this a lot with health systems because there's the initial change that you could make, there's the technology you could use to support it, but then how are you going to enforce it, especially if there's dissenters amongst the ranks, right? And we're talking about enterprise organizations sprawled around the country or region. But a really cool experience, Brian, and it's clear to me how a company like Rare could see like a tremendous value in having someone with your experience at the table. And I'm glad it worked out that way for you. What would you say is one of the most important things that you learned over the course of your journey, personally, professionally, or otherwise? And if you could think about it, like what was life before learning it, after learning it? Anything stick out in your mind?
Yeah, I think the thing, and I think my wife would probably attest to this, that it's a thing I'm still processing, still learning. I recall I went to a residential high school in Arkansas that was for math and science geeks. Now they've added an arts on end of it, and so there's lots of liberal arts people there too. But it was funny because I feel like I always felt a bit out of place as a kid. I thought about things differently. I was often more comfortable having conversations with some of my friends' parents than I was just hanging out and shooting the breeze with my peers. And I think for the longest time, I didn't take the time to recognize that I was just wired in a particular way, to think about problems in a particular way. And once I really embraced that, and I feel out of place, but I at least recognize why I'm out of place, and see that there are strengths there that when they're brought to bear in a human-centered way, can help people solve problems that otherwise they couldn't solve. And so I spent a fair amount of time in my career at Dell, I spent a fair amount of time just frustrated with the way things were done, with how complex things were. And at one point I had a mentor pull me aside and he said, Brian, you're gonna find And he highlighted a couple of metrics about this that I probably won't share. But he said, one of the things you're going to find is that by and large, the people here and the people at any organization tend to think very similarly. We tend to hire people who are like us. And even when we're thinking with a diversity, equity, inclusion mindset, like philosophically, we're still hiring people who kind of solve problems the way we do. We orient our interview questions around that. And we resonate with people who would solve the problem the way we solve it. We're not often thinking critically about people who took an entirely different approach and trying to think about that in terms of our net diversity. He said, so the problem then is you walk into a room as the person who thinks differently, who slipped through the cracks, and everybody else in the room is on the same page and is talking about how great the emperor's new clothes are. And you're the guy going, but he's naked. And that was a moment of me, for me going, okay, wow. So that does explain a lot of my frustration that I'm not like, even though these are educated, experienced, well-meaning, good people, we just don't see the world the same way. And so a lot of my frustration was often based on that problem. I like to tell when we have folks join the company, we do a fair amount. We don't do them as often. We went through a period for 2 or 3 years where you'd get a bunch of director VPs together at the organization. And the first thing they would do is toss out a personality assessment, whether it was Clifton Strengths or the DISC assessment or Working Genius or whatever it was. And I realized as this late in my career going, yeah, if you put 10 of us in a room and we take it, there's going to be 2 or 3 big groups. I'm going to be over here and I'll probably be by myself. And so I think I feel if I had learned that earlier, it probably would have reduced my stress and my frustration level. Because I feel like I'm a much more effective leader now that I understand that. Because I can look at my team and say, hey, I'm about to do something that's going to frighten the rest of you. Like I'm a little bit of a inventive, like I will go to the board with a problem and I want to whiteboard a problem and I literally want to throw spaghetti at the wall. And we may not get the complete solution, but we're going to at least tumble it around, understand the scope of that thing and figure out what do we not know. I imagine it not very different, maybe different in scope and dollar impact. But when you think about NASA, I'm a huge space nerd. When you think about NASA, okay, Kennedy's just said we're going to the moon by the end of the decade. Okay, that's the target. But if we're going to land a man on the moon, what do we have to know in reverse engineering that process? And it's funny because like I see in my staff now that I've become more conversant in my own style, where they used to sit back in that room and they're all just like, wow, I can't operate at that speed, or I'm not thinking about this. I don't feel comfortable giving feedback. They're all like deer in the headlights. Okay, don't, please God, don't call on me. Please don't make me be involved in this. Where now there's at least a level of they ask questions, they'll throw ideas out. And it took not them changing, it took me changing. It took me going, okay, now I understand how I'm operating. I'm understanding how that has an impact on you and your psychological safety in this space. And I'm intentionally creating space for you to be you and owning who I am, not trying to just wear a mask of something that I'm not. So he said, I would say that's still an ongoing learning, but that has probably been the thing that has been most impactful for me as a leader in the last decade.
No, that's huge, Matt. And that kind of self-knowledge, and it takes work, right? Like it takes personal and professional development in my experience, because I've gone through similar evolution as an executive. And I love what you're saying, though, because making space for people, enrolling them in what you're trying to do versus just being that. Because if I feel like I'm an outlier, then I'm an outlier, right? But if I'm stepping into who I am and then saying, hey, guys, this is okay, and what you're thinking is okay, let's talk about it. I really like that. There's lots of great things. But like one of the things that comes to mind, too, though, is like your come from is at the root of all innovation, which is a very necessary perspective this day and age in particular. I would argue that it always should have been, but like now more than ever, we need that at more organizations, because culturally, even if not like per each individual's personality, because a lot of the times they might be wearing masks too, depending on what group they fall in, they're being bonused off the status quo being maintained, or they know that they're not going to get fired if they don't rock the boat, right? But does that really serve the organization? In a lot of senses, probably not, right? What you're talking about, really throwing things up on the board and working towards understanding what I don't know, I don't know. And that's huge, right? Because how am I don't know my blind spots unless someone's helping me to find what they are.
Yeah. But I think especially cool. We've talked to, as an organization, we've talked a lot about like what is, and certainly like any organization, we have 5-year plans and we have goals of what we want to achieve and markets and customers and things like that. But it's interesting because we started a journey about a year ago to start really thinking about what does a digitalized version of this organization actually look like? And I think the first thing that our senior executive team learned is that they had a lot of homework to do about even just being able to rethink the functions that work for them. Perhaps my like simplest favorite example, though I think it certainly scares my colleagues in finance when I start talking about things like this, but I'm like, if you think about with generative tools and RPA and the way machine learning is trending, like most staff accounting can be automated. And it's not to say that accounting doesn't have serious value, but I pick that as a use case, I would say I could name 30 across my organization where there's a similar grade. Over the coming 5 years, you're going to see the work that you do shift dramatically if we're doing what we should do with technology. And to your point, or as my boss would say, most of us are just comfortable being comfortable. And he would say, as our chief transformation officer, he's like, I need all of you to be comfortable being uncomfortable, because the thing that is it Lincoln who famously is quoted as saying that the only sure things in life are death and taxes? I would probably add a third to that, which is death, taxes, and change. Like, you're going to continue to evolve and your job's going to continue to evolve. Technology is going to evolve. And I think generative AI has opened that up to a lot of people because they can start to see in their day to day how technology is dramatically changing what they are capable of. But like thinking about that alongside an entire organization and going to a CFO, going to our business unit presidents, talking to my peers across the organization and asking them to think about if they had to reshape, and they don't need to know how, but like if you had to think about what you know about technology, what could that mean? Ask some what ifs. What if this didn't have to happen? This thing that's really painful for your staff. Like for our manufacturing teams, we started on a journey several years ago of actually building or retrofitting connectedness into our factories. We've been building plastic things for a good long time. We've got lots of good processes. We have great design teams and really dedicated teams that work out on the floor, but their jobs are not easy. For a long time, we had people who their jobs were largely just moving material around. And if you look at how that's evolved with robotics and other things, we still have the same number of people, but we've changed the nature of their jobs. There's lots more automation that's moving product around, that's moving raw materials, that's making those jobs, even at the front line, less physical, more thinking. Now, it may be more, it's not necessarily strategic thinking, but it's more data, it's more responding to conditions, and it's less like I have to pick this thing up and palletize it here. For Rarig, that really reflects an ethos that says, like, I mean, we had a collection of folks that were retiring over the coming few months. And they put up a slide about their tenure, and it was like 30 to 40 years worth of time working in a factory for Rarig Pacific. Like, I can't imagine how difficult this job was 30 years ago. I know how difficult it was 3 years ago. And now we're starting to make it easier. But like being able to see that vision and then take into account the human problem of, if I go to my staff accounting team and I say, hey guys, I think a lot of your job can be automated. The first thing that wells up is, but I need a job. I got to put food on my table. And being able to predict that and say things like, okay, before we get too far down the path, you guys need to understand this organization is about to grow and scale. So the question is not, do you have a job? The question is, what's the shape your job is going to take over the next 5 years? Because if we double revenue, if we double the number of orders that are coming in, if we double the number of supplier invoices we have to deal with, my options are, I can either make your life much better through the use of technology, focus you on problems that your brain is uniquely built to solve and take all the menial things off your plate, then I can grow the business very profitably as you have exactly the same job security you had before. You're actually producing more value for the company, and it unlocks the ability for the organization to comfortably go out to the market and say, great, we're going to enter a new global space. We're going to enter an entirely new product line. We don't have to worry about the infrastructure scale behind the scenes in order to process all of those things, whether that's at the manufacturing, taking the orders, at servicing them within customer service, within finance, within any other department. And I think that it's, we're trying to figure out, and I don't think we've solved it yet, how do we give people the like safety and then the mental space to reimagine what their individual role could be and paint a picture of that for them.
I'm smiling because I wish we could have, and I know we tried to get you out of the summit in Austin, because we, the whole theme of the event was real intelligence elevating the human experience and demystifying the AI hype cycle. And one of the panels was geared towards exactly this, which is like, what does that upskilling look like? What, how are roles going to evolve and change? And to just give one basic example, like we talk about in healthcare a lot, like one of the most common use cases we're seeing is how we're using an agent assist tool, right? Where I'm leveraging a model to plug into a generative model to plug into a knowledge base, either a knowledge management platform or SharePoint or whatever it is. And then I'm leveraging natural language processing over the course of the conversation to query that data and feed the next best action or the knowledge article that's required to solve the issue or whatever it might be. And in healthcare, when I'm doing that as an access representative, above and beyond the initial CTI where the patients identified themselves and authenticated themselves, I get the patient data that populates, right? So I know who it is. So as opposed to saying name, date of birth, you're already on the phone with me, right? I could say, Brian, David here, I see you had a surgery last week. How are you feeling? And you're like, well, I'm not great. I just had surgery, but I'm recovering. Thanks for asking. Yeah. And I see on your chart here, you're probably calling to schedule your follow-up, like follow-up triggers that tree that you need to solve it. Like all of that, what it, for me, like it's letting me be there with that individual versus thinking about what I need to do next, where I'm typing on the keyboard and I'm trying to navigate. So again, just one basic example within an access contact center, but like in all those different roles, there's opportunity for that, whether it's being there with customer or my colleagues, how the role's evolving in just regard to how I'm thinking about what next. And really, and I it's funny because on a more grand scale, like how is this going to impact just education in general, like for students, right? When if they're no longer going to have to necessarily think about certain things, right? Like it's very interesting how this might all play out. And it's cool that you guys are like in the middle of it. We'll probably want to have a conversation a year or two from now and see how things go.
I agree. I think it's going to be a very interesting, and it's going to be a very interesting time. And it is an interesting time to be a digital innovator, because I think that's one of the things that, you know, I started to articulate for our executive team. I was like, look, right now, when we interview for roles, what we're really looking for is analog problem solvers who know their function really well. And my challenge, or our challenge as an organization, is that we have to start establishing, even in our interview processes, ways to identify people that are digital problem solvers, who don't accept that the work needs to stay the same. Because in my mind, I think about this with, I'll use a manufacturing example, right? In an analog automation world, I'm building ladder logic in a PLC, and lots of the components inside a manufacturing work cell they're fairly static. They respond to static known inputs. They don't respond flexibly. And so it's great. You set pin 12 went from low to high. So I now know I need to take this step. But you're not often passing digital artifacts where there can be this inference of the temperature. It's not pin high because I didn't hit an alert stage, but temperature is trending up 3% over the last 60 minutes. So I should react this way, which is very much a digital way to solve the problem. It's very nuanced. It's very condition based, but it's never divested from its context. Where, you know, in an analog space, it very often is. It's really right in the moment. A happened, I did B, and humans don't process that way really. Now they do, but they don't, I don't think they often understand what happens. You know, that visceral reaction I had when my wife said that thing is often tied to the 30 other times we've talked about that, whether positively or negatively. And so like, it's not just that one impulse that I'm responding to, but being able to think about that and then think about how do you start to build systems that have that level of capability, but that are very approachable, that whether you're in a good example of this is our sales team. You talk about that kind of customer experience of your first interaction with that customer on the phone is actually about the customer. It's not about revenue. It's not a technical thing. It's about the person that's on the other end of the phone. And we've talked a lot about, great, if we reshape, we're in the process of becoming a fully e-commerce enabled organization, which for a shop that 15 years ago was largely a like custom molder, you'd come and tell us what we needed, what you needed, and we'd figure out how to build it. That's a long philosophical road. It's a longer technical road. But our sales team has said, but our value is like, we do that work alongside the customer. And I said, no, your value is in helping the customer identify the problems we can solve. The product, we don't sell plastic. Now we do. But like at the end of the day, what you're selling when you're talking to that customer is actually reusability, right? We want to convert a customer off of whitewood pallets because the plastic, especially if it's got ocean reclaimed recycled material in it, it has a longer life cycle. It is much more economical. We are a cradle to cradle company. So you buy it from us and 10 years from now, when it's at the end of its useful life, you're going to send it back to me. I'm going to give you a credit. I'm going to ship it up and put it in the next product. So there's this huge sustainability story. I was like, that's what you're selling. That I can't articulate in an e-commerce store. That's your job. The order taking, the like functional placement of this logo on that thing, you have to do it today. But if you didn't have to do it, it would actually free you up to help that customer think about their business problems and help and let us help explore alongside them. That's value. And it's very much a similar frame of, let me stop being worried about, oh, great, you need an order status or you have a quality problem. And first thinking, being that trusted advisor for the customer, that's no, I actually care about you. I care about your organization. I care about your function. How do I help you to?
Yeah. And it's so funny, the like inverse relationship between this level of innovation and disruption and human connection, right? How like truly in being able to leverage this, it's going to enable folks to really get into it with their customers or their counterparts. And just, it amazes me. And it really gets me excited because that's where for me, joy lives in human connection and serving others. So talk about like getting more fulfillment from my job, the more that I can be in it with my customers and really feel like I'm contributing towards solving a problem or helping them get to that next level. That's fulfilling to me, right? And exciting. So I'm hopeful that will be the experience of our colleagues in the industry as we get into this next phase, because it is imminent, as you're saying, in almost all industry. But I think it's going to take leaders like yourself who can help educate and lead people to this new possibility. Hey, put your arm around them and say, you don't have to be scared, right? And even in that access example, right? It's not like we're like, because we're 40% more efficient now, right? We're not laying off half our staff. Really what we're doing is we're leveraging that efficiency, and there's actually a black cross that happens with, in this use case in particular, attrition, where we're just not having to rehire.
I think one thing that I would say to that is just a word of caution, I think, for all of your listeners. I think the thing is we need to be clear, and I think you're getting at this too, but I think we have to be clear, that's probably not the default place that this lands. Meaning like it's going to take thoughtful leaders to deliver that experience. And frankly, it's not even just leadership within organizations, but it's like, I often have conversations, like I'm talking with my wife about retirement and investments and things like this. I'm like, part of our challenge is that we as leaders want this thoughtful, personal approach that helps people think this way and feel this way, hopefully. But then we as investors actually punish companies who do it well. By and large, there's that focus on, hey, your EPS is down for the quarter, so stock prices drop, 15% and your net capitalization has gone down by $1 billion and you've just lost a ton of money, when the reason your EPS went down is because you actually made strategic investments in the technology and in people, and you didn't turn it into just a way to reduce headcount. And it's like that balance of both things, like we as leaders have to be thinking about it, but frankly, we as consumers have to be thinking about it as well. How are we spending our dollars and investing our time and our thinking in the rest of the world to help reflect that same challenge of we need to expect that there's going to be some shifts in those curves, and we've got to be in it more for the long haul than we do for just the next quarter. That to me is, it's risky.
Yeah. No, it's crazy. This has been awesome, Brian. So organic too. We're almost pretty much out of time here. My final question I always like to end on is just, if you could go back 5 or 10 years in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
It's tough. When I think about this question, I always immediately reflect that I'd like to give myself advice that wouldn't really dramatically change anything, in no small part because I think we as humans often learn as much through failure as we do through success, maybe more in some cases. And I think about, I've been married, I have my 10-year anniversary is in about a week and a half. And there's a piece of me that's, I'd really like to go back to college Brian and reset some of his thoughts and expectations around dating and building a personal life. But then I realized, like, what if I changed something that then didn't land me where I am with a fabulous, amazing, brilliant wife and 2 kids who, while they have their challenges, because all kids do, but they're amazing. And what if I changed something there? And so I think the thing I would say to myself then would be, this is a journey. And you need to be okay with where you're at on the journey. You need to be patient instead of just pushing through to try to get to the next thing. Because if you do, you're going to miss what's happening now. And it may not make sense for 5 or 10 years, but ultimately it's going to make sense. And being okay with that and being settled with that, I think would have created space for me to enjoy sections of my life that I feel like were just a slog to get to the next thing.
Wow. That is... I love the way that you answered that. Resonates with me fully. This has been great, Brian. It was such a pleasure having you on. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for your time, David. It's been great.
To our listeners, thank you all for tuning in, and we will catch you all next week.
Thank you for listening to the Disruptive Innovators Champions of Digital Business podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future episodes. This episode is brought to you by Disruptive Innovations, a leading tech consulting firm that helps enterprise organizations with their IT strategy, process optimization, and workflow improvement. Contact them and find out more at disruptiveinnovations.net.